When I got here, I had no idea what spirituality was. All I knew is that my life sucked and that I just wanted to stop drinking. You know, that's all I wanted out of this. And what I got is above and beyond, you know, anything that I thought was going to happen here. You know, the idea that, you know, somebody that has the same thing that I do, this disease of alcoholism, of addiction, could put together years of sobriety was so just out of the realm of possibilities. You know, to the point that, you know, when I got here, I remember looking around and hearing people talk about how long they had sober and just thinking, you don't have the same thing I have. You know, there's just no way. It's a really cool deal, you know, to be a part of this, though. I think it's amazing that, you know, these kinds of things exist in the first place, you know, these weekends. And I'm looking forward to getting to know a lot of you guys here. I see a lot of faces that I've never seen before, so hopefully we'll get to make some connections. Sobriety date is September 8, 2008. I was born into a perfectly normal alcoholic family. Mom was a felony probation officer for Gwinnett County. That would present some problems for me down the road. My father was a traveling salesman and worked in the sign business for a number of years. He was a pretty bad alcoholic as well. And I had a brother who was a saint. Everything this guy touched turned to gold. And then you take one look at my punk ass. You know, he was going to get the positive attention and I was going to get the negative attention. You know, I was actually born in Birmingham, Alabama. And moved to Atlanta, Georgia. I was probably 6 months old, out to Gwinnett County specifically. And I loved sports. I loved it. I loved being the center of attention. My brother was also a soccer player, so we kind of had that in common. And I don't have a whole lot of memories from my early childhood. One of the first memories that I have, and it's one of those things, like I don't even know if it's a memory. All I know is that I've heard the story time and time again about being at a family wedding, me finding some sort of a spiked fruit punch bowl, and getting completely shit-faced at the age of 6. You know, so that was my first experience with alcohol. Dad got sober in 87. He died sober back in 2020. Now, interestingly enough, he actually died of cirrhosis of the liver. So even after being sober for 30 years, it still came back and got him. Obviously I was around a lot of alcohol, you know, from an early age. We grew up Catholic. We drank at church, you know. And then at some point, I think my brother converted to Baptist, and you know, the dynamic in the family was really taking its toll. We were always really dysfunctional, but at some point mom and dad had started to kind of, you know, realize, hey, this isn't working. You know, we probably need to do something about this situation for the family, you know. And so he left, went and got remarried, and I think the first actual memory that I have is being in the brand new house that my mom had just purchased, and there was no furniture. And I remember looking around and just thinking, this is very lonely. I don't understand why there's not furniture in this place. I don't understand why my dad's not here. I just didn't understand anything. And so I just felt very alone. Luckily, it wasn't going to take long until I would find some people in the neighborhood could show me a solution to my problem, you know, to this loneliness. You know, at this point, mom's alcoholism had progressed rapidly. She would get off work about 4 o'clock, and she was passed out by probably 5 or 6 every day, you know, which pretty much gave me free rein to go out there and do whatever it is that I wanted to do, you know. And you know, I remember going to her bathroom, and I remember what the bottle looked like. And it was Evan and Williams. And I would go in there and I would take a pull. Just as much as I needed to, you know. And I don't know at what frequency that was back then, because, I mean, I'm 12 years old, you know, but I know I started drinking probably around like 11, pretty consistently. And I was starting to show some signs of some severe behavior problems, you know, about that time. I'd started middle school, was getting in trouble every chance I got. Suspended from school for fighting. I was on a downward spiral. So mom and dad took me to go see a therapist, and then a family psychologist, and then ultimately a psychiatrist to try to figure out what was wrong with me. First mental institution when I was 12 years old, second when I was 13, first rehab when I was 14. I got started quick. I wanted to do whatever I had to do to get out of this moment. I do not know, without some sort of spiritual program, without some sort of substance, I don't know how to be in this moment. I don't know how to sit here and have a conversation with you guys face to face and look you in the eye and tell you what's going on with me. That was not built into me. One of my first memories of getting sober this time was seeing a guy named Brett that I'd known for many, many years outside of the Gwinnett room, and having a conversation with him, and the anxiety was so high. Just sitting there talking to the man, there was nobody else around, I literally had to turn around and walk away in mid-sentence. I couldn't do that kind of stuff. So, needless to say, when I got that first drink in me, you know, when I was 11, 12 years old, something happened. I felt like I found a way to exist in this world. That being said, I started to feel very different from an early age. Going to a mental institutions, 12, 13. I'm on the soccer team. People are asking, where's Rush? He's at Peachford. You know, he's back at Peachford. He's at Ridgeview. It was very unnatural, you know. And, you know, I wasn't the smartest guy in the room, but I was smart enough to realize that, like, hey, this shit's not happening to other people. You know, so there must be something wrong with me, you know. So the first rehab that I went to when I was 14 years old was called Atlanta Insight. I stayed there for about 3.5 years. And really what Atlanta Insight did is it taught me the world of addiction. You know, up to that point I had only dropped acid and smoked pot and, you know, drank a good bit of liquor, you know. But I heard stories of crackheads, and I heard stories of methamphetamine, and I heard, you know, this, that, and the other. And I remember leaving that place saying, I can't wait to do this shit. So that's just how my brain worked, you know. And here's the thing, I mean, I knew from an early age that, I mean, when whatever it is, it doesn't matter what it is, liquor, meth, any of the hard stuff preferably, but when it hits my system, I mean, I love it with every fiber of my being, what it does to me. The effect is so powerful. And I know you guys get that. You know, that's one of the coolest things I think that I found when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was, you know, telling these stories to people and then hearing their stories and, like, realizing that after all the years, the psychiatrist and the therapist and going to church and feeling like an outcast in church because those people didn't get me, and then finally finding my people here, that was so huge for me. So I think it took me about a year and a half to get 30 days sober in that program. When I finally did get a little bit of time, I think I got like 14 months clean. I met a girl in that program, and we'd both been clean for about a year. Experienced heartache for the first time. She was way too pretty for me, and she knew it. And you know, that program was pretty unique in terms of just the way that it was ran, because they didn't want you to get a job. They didn't want you to really have any kind of contact with other people outside of that program. I mean, you were in a bubble, essentially. So when I left that program, I say left, I really got kicked out. I went back to my mom's house. I told you my family's sick. At this point, my mom and dad had gotten back together. So the toxic back and forth had began. And, you know, again, I was just kind of left with the same dilemma. I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know how to be in the world. I didn't know how to be sober. You know, I didn't have a relationship with any kind of power greater than me. I might have worked some steps in that program, but I mean, it was kind of few and far between, and I certainly didn't work all 12, you know. So, that being said, I mean, I had no idea what a spiritual experience was. So, come back to mom and dad's. In that house, age 17, maybe 18 by then, and ended up getting a job at a car dealership and met some people who seemed to drink like I drank. And so that's what we started doing. We started drinking a lot, weekdays, weekends. It wasn't completely out of control. And, you know, the reason I say that is because, like, when my addiction is in full force, I'm completely unemployable. There's no such thing as personal relationships. And those things were still intact at that time, you know. So, you know, it didn't take long for me to find, you know, the crowd that I fit in with, you know. And when that happened, I stopped going to work. And I needed a way to, you know, to figure out how to, you know, feed this habit that I had. I experimented with methamphetamine for the first time, and that took me to places that I didn't know existed. And I was up 5 days, down two, you know, at the age of 19, living out of hotel rooms, sometimes on the street, you know, stealing cars, wallets, purses. I mean, anything I could do to just, you know, get by in the world and just continue to feed the beast. And at one point, I got set up by a confidential informant at a gas station. For some reason, I took off. The cops were chasing me, and I took off inside the gas station. I'm still not sure why I did that. But I'm pretty sure I had been, you know, 72, 76 hours no sleep. You know, so it kind of checks out if you think about it, you know. And so I had this bag of methamphetamine, and I swallowed it whole. Bag comes open in my stomach. I wake up shackled to a bed in Gwinnett Medical Center, just outside of Atlanta. And it was my first moment of, like, somewhat severe consequences, you know? Just waking up kind of shackled to a bed was just kind of, you know, to me it was kind of cool because it was kind of like movie-esque, you know what I mean? Like, I got a cool story to tell now. But, you know, I'll never forget what the cop said to me that was in the room with me. He said, you know, you're just one of the ones that happened to wake up. And that hit me, you know? I don't know how much time I spent in jail that time. Probably, you know, a couple weeks. You know, went to arraignment, got out, started doing the same thing again. Again, I just had no solution, you know. So, ended up, you know, just continuing to live the way that I had been living. Went back to jail for a possession charge of some kind and stayed there for about 8.5 months. And while I was in jail for 8.5 months, I remember thinking, okay, this is not working. You know, I should probably start thinking about an alternative plan here. You know, because what I'm doing is just not working anymore. And I remembered that my father had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he stopped drinking in 87. And so I decided that when I got out, I was going to start going to some meetings. And so that's what I did. got a couple fights in jail. And I got my ass beat by a guy this tall. I mean, he caught me out of nowhere. I was in the medical pod for probably a couple days. I mean, it was pretty bad. And that was just kind of icing on the cake. Like, hey, man, like I'm really kind of tired. I'm getting tired. you know, of this lifestyle. And so I got out, started going to a meeting, you know, with my dad. Eventually I ventured over to the Gwinnett Room because it was a clubhouse and there were hot young girls there, which was the last thing I needed. Didn't know it at the time. But luckily I found a guy. When he shared things that I identified with. And he seemed to be different. He didn't seem to, when he shared, he wouldn't put on a show for anybody. You know, we've seen those people. I've been that guy, actually. And it just came from the heart. It was real. It was his own experience. And he started taking me through the 12-step process. And I was not a believer. Again, I mean, there was so much that I had to work through. I remember coming in and I remember looking up on the wall and seeing the steps up there and looking at, you know, I could get down with 1 and 2. You know, I had some issues with God. I didn't know how to do step 3. That didn't make sense to me. How do you turn your will and your life over the care of something that you don't have a relationship with or a connection with? And I didn't have a connection. All I knew is that when I was probably 12, 13 years old, my brother had tried to save me, you know, as the downward spirals had started. And I remember walking into church, and I remember the preacher being up there in the Southern Baptist sanctuary and him saying, you know, if you do A, B, and C, you're going to burn in hell. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, well, all right, God, I'm going to make a promise. I'm not going to do these things. And by 5 p.m., I had broken every single promise. I didn't have the power to do something like that. I didn't have the connection. But what that did was it told me that I wasn't good enough for God. And not only did I didn't think that I was good enough for God, I didn't think that I was good enough for you guys. You know, I didn't know how to have relationships. And so that was a part that I really struggled with. So to sum that up, you know, when I'm looking at these steps and I'm meeting with a sponsor for the first time, there's a lot of questions. I'm not bought into this, you know. For whatever reason, I made a decision to go through this process. And I really don't think that it was out of desperation. And here's why. Not because my life had not gotten bad enough. I was convinced that I was powerless and my life was unmanageable. That part I was clear about. But if you don't come crawling in here, like off the street, you got that. I had that 8.5 month buffer of being in jail. And I think there was almost a part of me that lost that desperation. And so when I finally did get to work on the steps, I just think that it was kind of half-hearted, you know, for lack of a better term. But I'm still very grateful for it, and here's why. So, started the inventory process, you know, got that done, sat down to do a fifth step with this sponsor. His name was Ed S. I think his home group was the Lilburn group or Fifth Tradition or something like that. He knew all the right things to ask. At the end of the fifth step. And I had held on to some things that I needed to share with another man, you know, very, very badly. And I was able to do that, and that was very powerful. I remember having the experience of what I thought to be the obsession leaving me at that point. Okay? Continued on through the process, you know, through 6 and 7, had me read it in the 12 and 12. One of my biggest fears coming into Alcoholics Anonymous was looking up at the wall and realizing that I'm going to have to make amends for all the dirty shit that I've done. And so, I started making the list. And I remember having several conversations with Ed and saying, you know, there's a few on this list, man, that I don't think I can do because I think that I'm probably going to go to prison if I do. And the real reason is that I was just scared shitless. And I'm really grateful for that man because he had worked through these steps thoroughly and he had sponsored men and he knew what to say to something like that. You know, and he took me to the part of the book that tells us that we don't get to choose who we make amends to. You know, we do the dirt, we got to make it right. And that's just part of the process. And I'm really, really grateful for that. Made, you know, a few of the easy ones first just to kind of get my feet wet a little bit. There was one guy who my father used to live with, and he actually, the guy actually kicked my father out after 9/11 when he was jobless. And I think that he'd already been kicked out or something like that. And I remember I was jonesing pretty bad one night. And I drove out to his house and I broke in and I stole everything that had any kind of value whatsoever. And so, you know, at this point, Ed had convinced me that I need to go out here and make this amends. So I saved up $1,100 and I put it in an envelope and I drove out there. And it was a really powerful experience. I don't even remember really like how I knew, because I don't know how I got there, if that makes sense. I don't think I looked up directions. It's kind of like I just got in the car and I just went. It's almost like I was guided through the whole process. But I'll never forget the feeling that I had pulling up to his house that day, knowing that I had to go and tell this man what I did. And of course, I had the envelope in my back pocket, and I pull up, and my knees are shaking, and I, you know, walk up the steps, and I knock on the door, and he opens the door, and I looked him in the eye, and I told him who I was. You know, I'm Russ Jolly. I'm Steve's son. I broke into your house. I took everything that had any kind of value, and I'm here to pay you back because I'm trying to get sober. And so I hand him the envelope, and he takes the envelope, and he peels off $300, and he puts it in his pocket, and then he hands me the envelope back, and he says, "You're going to need this a lot more than I am." And he said, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for coming here today." And it was, you know, that was the day. I still get chills every time I tell the story, every time I think about it, because, you know, you hear in meetings that this is divinely inspired, you know, and you just kind of hope it is, you know, until you have your own experience. And that day I started to buy in. I was like, okay, like there's something to this God thing here. It became pretty clear that we're not alone here, you know, especially when we do this process. And I'm really grateful for that because, you know, the feeling that I had driving away from that man's house that day was better than anything I'd ever experienced in my life. And it gave me the motivation to continue on, you know, with the rest of the steps and to start, you know, start sponsoring people. And so that's what I did. I think I'd gotten a job with a land survey company and was doing pretty well. Didn't really love the work, but was just grateful for a job. Was going to meetings and sponsoring guys and doing the things that the people in these rooms told me to do. And I was connected, you know. And then I met a girl. her name was Jennifer, and I was thinking about her on the way over here, and it dawned on me. Jennifer is exactly like my mother, which is kind of sick, but it kind of checks out too, you know. If you've been to therapy, you know what I'm talking about. And I've been to lots of therapy. But she was a pretty bad alcoholic, and she couldn't stay sober. And, you know, I got to see some pretty nasty things. And, you know, her disease was pretty advanced, you know, for a girl in her 20s, you know. And when she would drink, she would act just like my mom did. You know, she'd bitch at me the same, and she'd just over dramatic, and, you know, just the list goes on. And at some point I started pulling away from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started being dishonest about the things that were going on in my life. And I would learn that lesson, you know, eventually. But at that point, I don't think that I understood the value of telling another man every nook and cranny of my life. And not just in an inventory. I'm talking about it on a daily basis. You know, I'm convinced now because, you know, being sober for a little while now, you know, I look back and we're alcoholics. You know, we're gonna have some wonderful things happen to us here in Alcoholics Anonymous in all aspects of our life, especially if we do the steps and we do them consistently. But another thing that is inevitable is that we're going to do some really dumb shit along the way, you know? And I'm really grateful for that lesson in dishonesty, because I've learned that I don't get to have secrets today. I gave up that right. Some people can do that. They can, you know, do some dirty shit and never tell a soul and get through life and somehow make it. And maybe they're dying inside, I don't know. But what happens to me when I do stuff like that, like, it will lead to my death. I know that now. So I just don't do it. I'm talking about all the shameful shit that happens. I'm talking about the massage parlors. I'm talking about all the shit that embarrasses you. There's a room full of 112 men in here right now, and I know there's a lot of people that know what I'm talking about. That's the kind of shit we got to talk about. We got to talk about it. I'm not saying the behavior's okay. That's not what I'm saying. But if you're doing stuff like that, find somebody and talk about it. Don't keep it a secret. I really do believe that's how I got to stay sober for so many years now. I think without that, I think I'm drunk many years ago. I really do. So all that led to a relapse. And I stayed out there for another 2 years. And I thought I had seen all that active addiction had to offer. That's just not the case. Not for us. You know, we take it to another level. You know, we go deeper and deeper. It just keeps getting darker and darker. It's a progressive illness that we have here. And I ended up in places that, you know, I just have no interest in, man. I just don't ever want to go back there again. And and it, you know, like I said, it lasted a couple of years. And it was... the morning it all ended was powerful for me. I was in a stolen car. And I really got lucky because I didn't know that there were, you know, cops, you know, following behind me. They had followed me from a Walmart or something like that. Apparently they had lost me. I had kind of like pulled my car like under a tree in a neighbor's house, which I never did. So I really got lucky because they knew the house because it was kind of a hot spot, you know, in that particular area. And they started shining the spotlights, and I, you know, I knew what time it was, man. I knew we were all going to jail, and when my back hit the back of the seat, I breathed a sigh of relief. I was just so great. I was so tired. I was just so tired of doing the same shit over and over again. I mean, I don't know how many times I've been robbed and beaten with baseball bats and just had my ass kicked. And I mean, it never ended. And I was just so tired of that life. And but I didn't know how to stop it. You know, those 2 years were just a perfect representation of the physical allergy. You know, just me just not having the ability to stop what I was doing and wanting to with like every fiber of my being. I didn't want to be doing those things, you know. I remember one Christmas during those 2 years, I think I was coming down pretty good, and, you know, my mom and my dad had agreed to let me have a six pack to kind of take the edge off. And so, you know, I got through the six pack, and, you know, that just wasn't doing the job. You know, it just wasn't doing it. And I remember walking out the front door and my family coming out after me because they knew what was going on. And my brother is literally on Christmas Day in the front yard on his hands and his knees crying, begging for me not to go. And I love that dude with everything, man. I love him so much. And I didn't have the ability to... I didn't have the power. You know? The ride was just right down the street, and I knew what would happen if I could just go get in the car. I could breathe. And I couldn't breathe in that house, not with those people, not in my current state. And I just didn't want to be doing those things. But I couldn't stop it. So, in the cop car, you know, get to the jail, spend probably 6.5 months there. There was a guy named Daniel L., who I'll be grateful for, you know, for the rest of my life, because, you know, had tried to help me prior to, you know, the relapse, and he kind of saw the spiral starting, and I called him, and he was gracious enough to come up to that jail and to work the steps with me through the plexiglass. And so so that's how it started for me. And that was September 8, 2008. And that, you know, that time in jail was very different from the first time. This time there was a humility about me. Maybe it was fear. Humility is a strong word. Yeah, probably just a lot of fear. Just wanting to get through it. You know, just knowing I probably got 6 or 7 months here, man. Just put your head down. Yes, sir. No, sir. You know, mind your damn business. Get through this. Get out of here. And you know, we'll figure out what the plan looks like then. And so that's what I did. And I got out. And, so fucking stupid, man. I got to learn these lessons so many times. So I get out and, you know, start going to meetings at the Gwinnett Room. And just the early recovery. I mean, you know, you're playing volleyball till 1 a.m. You're going out to eat after meetings. You're just really just kind of looking for the meetings with the hot girls. I mean, that's just... You know, that was kind of my MO even at that point, you know. And again, it was just kind of like I had that 6.5 month buffer, so I just didn't have that desperation, you know. And so I kind of got out and I was just kind of running on self-will, you know. And it's really kind of a sad story because I met another girl. And she was just as sick as I was. And we got into a very toxic relationship. And at some point, I had gone to a meeting the next town over in Snellville, and it was a meeting called the Solution Group. And when I walked in there, the fear that overcame me was so profound, because what I saw, you know, being a scared little kid, I was a boy. I didn't know what it meant to be a man. And when I walked in there, I saw men. And when I saw those men, I could see that they knew how to live. And I believed that they had the same thing that I had. And so what did I do? I didn't go back for quite some time. But I remembered... you know, I believed that me going to that meeting that night was divinely inspired. Because I knew when I did find that desperation, I was going to go back there and things were going to happen to me. I was going to experience a psychic change for the first time in my life. Maybe the second. I'm not sure if the first was a psychic change, but it was definitely a spiritual experience, you know, in the night step. So the toxic relationship continued for a little bit longer, and until I just ran out of gas, man, and I was just so burnt. I was just so sick of my self-will and just ended up back in the same place time and time again. And there was a guy named Scott F. And he had been in a very similar relationship. And he knew he had ended that relationship successfully. And so I went to him and I said, "Dude, can you help me?" And he was like, "Yeah, meet me at the meeting. You know, get there about 7:15 or so." So I got there about 7:15. Meeting started at 8. And I sat in his car, and I called her on speakerphone, and I told him I told her exactly what he told me to tell her, so that I would close that door and not reopen it. And so I did that, and I didn't reopen the door. And I went into that meeting, and I got phone numbers, and I went back the next on Thursday, and I was there twice a week for a number of years, and I met my sponsor, Mike C. He's in this room today. There was just something about him. I don't know, he just spoke to me. When he shared in meetings, I just knew what he was talking about was real. So we started in the steps. And I probably had coming up on 2 years sober maybe. you know, at this point, I didn't have a job, I don't think. I think I was playing poker till 6 a.m. I cashed out a 401k that somehow I'd forgotten about. And so, man, we just got to work. And it was really powerful because in conjunction with working the 12 steps of AA and doing some really, really hard stuff, because again, you know, the anxiety was so much for me, it was really difficult. I mean, it was like every time I pulled into that parking lot, hopefully some people have had this experience, but every time I pulled in, it was like I just had to gas myself up, dude. Like you got this. Just move your feet. Just open the door, step out, and just start walking toward the door. That's all you got to do. And then just get to the doorknob. Just open the doorknob and just walk in. And it was and walking in was like the hardest thing that I had ever done. And I don't know if that's the disease, like that's just like really trying to kill us, or if it's just, you know, a lack of confidence, self-esteem, growing up in a dysfunctional family. I don't know what the case is, but that was my experience. And he guided me through that. Eventually, I made it to the point where I could actually start chairing meetings. And doing those hard things was so important for me. It seemed so small and so, not meaningless, but it just seems like such a small task to overcome. But at the time, it was such a big deal for me. And I remember I would leave the meeting and I'd be exhausted. Like I would just be so tired. Like I just got to get home. You know, just go get in the bed. Because what was going on up here was just, it was just like a circus. Just nonstop. And so we started going through the 12-step process. He had me read a book called A New Pair of Glasses by Chamberlain. And in reading that book, I had heard things that I had never heard before. You know, he said things like, you know, go be of service for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. And at the time, I hated my family so much, man. And Mike would tell me, you know, just go home, man. Go do the dishes. Go vacuum the living room. Go empty the ashtrays. Just go do these things. And so I just started doing what the dude told me to do. And I still struggled, man. The fear was pretty overwhelming at times. And pretty shortly thereafter, he had me read another book. It was called A Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. And that book opened my mind to things that I had never been exposed to before. You know, I think up to this point, I don't think I'd really had a spiritual experience. I'd had some powerful experiences, but in reading those two books and going through the steps and doing the inventory process and going through the ninth step, making those amends, at some point something happened to me, and I shifted, and it's really hard for me to put words on it. It's almost like the language that we know, it's so limited. Like, you can't really talk about things that happen internally sometimes. But the best way I can describe it is a spiritual experience. I began to become aware of something besides just what we're aware of here, which is the physical plane. You know, seeing this building and trees and people and jobs and going to work and, you know, cars. Just all very physical. And there was something that was being opened up to me throughout this process. And I believe that it was the start of me truly developing a relationship with a power greater than me. And it was a really cool experience. I stayed there for about 3 weeks in this just very spiritual place. And I experienced a lot of love, and I was just hungry. I was hungry for more. I would read whatever books people told me to read. I would go to meetings all over the city of Atlanta. I mean, I was just kind of on a mission. And I wasn't focused on, you know, distracting myself with other things like I had in the past. Like, I was really focused on just, like, right here, right now. And it wasn't just that. There was a part of me that was really scared. I was scared to even, like, look at females. Because to me, that was, like, the real danger. Like, because as soon as I do that, as soon as that relationship starts, like, I'm so fucked. Like, I just didn't have the power. You know what I mean? And all I had ever known was just toxic relationships, you know? There was a girl that actually started coming to Solutions, and she had, you know, probably a year and a half, like maybe 2 years sober. She was working steps, doing the deal. And it was really kind of cool because, like, there was a lot of people in my life that were like, Rush, like, what are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? And I just kept saying, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I can't do that. I knew I was going to screw it up. I didn't want to screw it up again, you know? But it was really cool because I had these men that had guided me and kind of took me under their wing and, like, started to show me how to be a man. And I kept hearing the same thing from all of them. Hey, man, I think that girl over there is waiting on you. You need to go see about her. And I did, and she broke my fucking heart. Thanks a lot, Mike. I mean, that's the short version, but the long version is that, you know, I learned how to have a meaningful relationship with somebody, you know. And I didn't do it in just pure and total self-will. I did it with guidance and direction from people that I loved and respected who had worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And every time the jealousy would come up, I mean, I'd step away. I'd literally walk out the side of the restaurant and I'd call somebody. Because, like, that's what you guys taught me to do. Because I didn't know how to do it. So you were teaching me how to get through these things and how to start living. And it was really a beautiful thing. And we had a great relationship for a number of years. You know, I'll talk a little bit about work. You know, when I first got sober, I think my first job was at a car wash. God, I hated that job. And then I got a job at a restaurant. And so here's the thing. So I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I had no idea. I didn't know what I was good at. I mean, all I knew up to that point, man, I just did whatever I could do to get out of this present moment. You know what I mean? And so a lot of this stuff was so brand new. Just having conversations with people sober still took so much energy for me, you know, at 2-3 years sober. And I just felt like, I've been sober for 3 years now. Like, I should be further along than this, you know? Like, this can't be right, you know? The fear was just, I was just still, I got embarrassed so easily. I just remember being called on in a meeting and just wanting to fucking die. So if that's your experience, like, just know, like, you're not alone, you know, if you're here. But in working in this restaurant, I figured out pretty quick that, like, I knew how to talk to people. Like, I could get up here and do this, you know? And I didn't know that. I think people had told me that when I was younger, maybe, but I just had no clue. So I kind of started looking, okay, at least I kind of have a direction now. I'm gonna go towards something in sales, you know, and just see what happens. Just see what God has for me. So that's what I did. I worked at a restaurant. Got fired at that restaurant from screaming at my boss in front of the whole restaurant. Went to work at another restaurant and did pretty well there. And then met somebody in the program that worked for a vacation company. And she was like, man, I think you'd be really good at this job. We were selling timeshares. So basically she looked at me and said, you look like a real scumbag. Come with me. She was a hell of a saleswoman too. God, she could sell. It was a really cool experience, man, because, you know, I started working in that sales job, and I'm so competitive. Just my nature is just to be competitive. You'll probably see some of it this weekend. I'll probably embarrass myself doing something, but I don't know, man. I just became focused. I was just like, God, I love this shit. you know, I just love this competitive aspect of this. And somebody go sell two, and I'd be like, all right, I'm going to go sell three. And I go sell three, you know. And so I did that for a little while, and then I got my own store and started managing a team, and then I got to build a team. And then that was kind of the first moment where I was like, oh, I like to build things. I didn't know that. So that was kind of a cool revelation that I had there. And so I did that for a little while. And I think the girl and I broke up in like 2016 maybe. And of course I was devastated. And I think I was looking to kind of distract myself with something brand new. And so a friend of mine recruited me to come and work for a treatment center. So I started working in the treatment space for a treatment center, drug and alcohol treatment center. And I did that for a number of years. And then a couple of years ago, I think this is important to mention, I realized that I had some outside issues that needed to be addressed. Basically the short version. And if anybody has questions about this stuff, ask after. Please feel free to talk. I'll be happy to talk to you about it because I will nerd out on this shit all day long. I love it. But I started going to therapy. And specifically a hypnotherapist. And she was trained in all sorts of different trauma modalities. And so I just started down that path. I did a somatic meditation course. I did... another thing happened. I met a therapist at a detox one time. I was there marketing. And I met a therapist, and she was so special. There was something about this woman. She was the most compassionate, empathetic individual that I'd ever met in my life. And I remember thinking, walking away from that day, I remember thinking, okay, if I ever start a program, I'm going to get her. So just kind of the culmination of all these things, of going to therapy and kind of starting down that, you know, that holistic healing path, for lack of a better term. And I just really loved it, man. And I really got involved. I really started to kind of focus more on the 11th step. I don't think up to that point I had really ever taken meditation very seriously. I just skipped right over that part, you know. And so I started meditating on a daily basis. And I started doing some work with a guy who was the CEO of a treatment center in Georgia. And I really, really respected this guy. And he started breathing life into me. And the stuff that came out in these sessions that I had with him was that I like to build things. He kept hearing, I'm not happy where I'm at. And I told him one day, just out of the blue, man, I think I want to start a program. I think I want to start my own treatment center. And he looked at me and he told me, he was like, Rush, if you want to do this, I want you to know that I will get behind you 100%. I will support you in any way that you need. Like, you can do this, but you got to believe that. And I'm really, really grateful for that because I started that journey with him. And I opened my own treatment center last July. And I went and got that therapist, and she's our program director. And we've probably got 21 clients in that program right now. We have a heavy emphasis on trauma, but we're also huge advocates of the 12 steps. People got to be through an inventory by the time they get to 6 weeks, and they got to be in the ninth step by the time they graduate. It's been one of the coolest experiences I've ever had. You know, just not knowing that I was capable of doing anything in this life. And then just really just kind of trusting you guys along the way. And just kind of going where I'm led. And just meeting the right people at the right times. And getting to do something that I really love with people that I really love. It's a pretty special gift we have here. And I believe that that's available to anybody and everybody. You know, but... You know, Mike, you told me a long time ago, man, you said the value's in the seeking. And I have used that in most aspects of my life. And I really do believe that you know, God is concerned with me to the extent that I seek Him. Dude, it's just been an amazing ride. It's been an amazing ride. You know, when I got here, I remember walking into the Gwinnett room and just seeing the yellow walls and the yellow ceiling tiles and the ashtrays and the old dudes everywhere and just thinking, my fucking life is over. I mean, I was just so disgusted. I really did. I mean, I just had no idea that I would meet my best friends here. I had no idea that I would, you know, get to start a business and do something that I love. And it means so much, man, because, I mean, I'll tell you guys, this treatment industry, it is such a dirty business. It's so fucking dirty. You would not believe it. I mean, 90% of the places in Atlanta, Georgia, are just all they give a shit about is collecting an insurance check. That's all they care about. They don't care about these people. And I'm not trying to paint myself white as snow or holier than thou, but, you know, the place that I have fucking cares about people. It's just a beautiful thing to be a part of. It's a beautiful thing to create something. It's a beautiful thing to come in here and do this process and let God take me where He wants me to be. And, you know, when you do it and you're on that path, you know, you just kind of have that feeling like I'm just exactly where I'm supposed to be in this moment. And I've had that experience many times along the way over the last, you know, 14 and a half years. And I just can't thank the people in these rooms enough. I just can't. Just being the scared little kid that I was, man, growing up the way that I grew up and doing the things that I'd done and screwing over all those people, and now I get to be up here and I get to do things like this, and I get to live a life that's just so far above and beyond what I thought it could be. It's not perfect. I don't, you know, subscribe to this idea that freedom is just around the corner, because it's not. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to have trials and we're going to have shit that happens along the way, and it's going to be tough. And sometimes sobriety fucking sucks. But for me, man, it just, this, like, doing this deal beats it every single time from where I came from. So thanks.